Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are discussing chapter 31 of Wuthering Heights and then reading chapter 32. The questions I asked were these. It's a little confusing. Lockwood seems to see Kathy, too, as the mean brat that she is, but is also still attracted to her. Why do you think? Also, Lockwood is already making headway in setting things right. Do you think he'll do more harm or good? And so a few people seemed surprised / interested by something that happened in the previous chapter, chapter 30. Did I miss something? Reddit user Plant Some Trees said, by knowing all the history, maybe he is empathizing and wants to save her from the reality she is doomed in that place. That, and it seems she is good looking. Question 2, will Lockwood do more harm or good? Plant Some Trees says, oh, I'm so preparing for the worst. And in regards to the third question, a thing that I missed, I don't know, is it that Nally may be plotting to get Lockwood interested in Kathy and vice versa, maybe? Techrific said yes, that was the big reveal about Nally in the last chapter. Okay, cool. I did kind of miss that. I mean, I don't know, it just seems like something that she would do, right? But yeah, no, I kind of missed that. I don't think it really had an impact on me, that line about her getting them together. It just seems like something, you know, like an old auntie or someone would just say that, oh, you seem nice, you should get together with her. But yeah, it kind of just went in one ear and out the other. Swim said the mama fish, she said, given Lockwood's lurid interest in all things Wuthering Heights and his offhand remark of interest in Kathy, I found it interesting that he decided to leave before he had paid another visit to Heathcliff. I was looking forward to some more comedic mayhem to see Lockwood try to verify Nellie's story and woo Kathy. Regarding question 1, why is he still into Kathy? Because she's really, really pretty. And question 2, I'm not seeing how Lockwood is setting things right. I think what I was referring to mostly there was like, he was... He's got context around all these things that's going on, maybe even more than Kathy. Like, Kathy just sees Harriton as a big idiot and doesn't really understand him on a deeper level, whereas Lockwood knows the backstory and the history. And so he does some little corrections there, like... He sort of says to Kathy not to be mean to Harriton about trying to read and... And little things like that. So he is kind of starting to meddle a little bit with their dynamic, which I think could be a good thing. Techrific said, how interesting that the scheming and calculating Heathcliff had not counted on a spiring connection between Harriton Earnshaw and Kathy Heathcliff. But that this budding romance should reach fruition didn't seem to make him as angry as we could have expected. That Harriton resembles Catherine, one, was also unexpected. I must have forgotten that Heathcliff's love was Harriton's aunt. Great irony in this chapter, and the bickering and teasing, although bitter for Harriton, read as young lovers quarrel to me. Maybe I'm the only one. Wasm said, Lockwood sure thinks highly of himself. I don't see him actually doing anything of consequence. But maybe he'll surprise me. Techrific said, yes, I also noted that he is using Nally's word, e.g. clown. That Nally's epithet for Harriton, misanthropist, again Nally's word for Heathcliff. He's bought Nally's account in judgment, hook, line and sinker. Not saying Nally isn't right, at least about Heathcliff, but it's interesting to note how her biased view has now totally become Lockwood's own. Neuropsychology works that way, and as human beings, we are so prone to making errors in memory recall. I wouldn't be surprised if Lockwood hasn't convinced himself that these judgments are his and his alone, and not something he's picked up from Nally. Emily Bronte must have been a keen observer of humankind and our weird and wonderful quirks. I did notice that too, that he had adopted a few of the same adjectives that Nally had used to describe these people. And that is an interesting thing to note, that Emily Bronte must have been a very keen observer of humankind, that she's embedded that little obscure human trait, but also quite a familiar one, into the character. And in such a subtle way, too. Gwynardle said, "I imagine a lot of Lockwood's attraction is due to the lack of options. There have been many mentions of how isolated they are. If Nally and Zilla are the only women he has seen for months, Kathy, too, is probably starting to look pretty good. Do we even know how old Lockwood is?" I don't know that we do. And yeah, he doesn't have many options out in Wuthering Heights in the moors, but he is planning to return to London. So, you know, there's going to be plenty of options in a place like London. Starfall 15 said, "I feel Lockwood is too nonchalant with what he heard for the past few days from Mrs. Dean. He should be less judgmental concerning Harriton and Kathy, and less amiable to Heathcliff. In his place, I would have delivered Mrs. Dean's message to Kathy and informed my landlord of my decision to leave, but most definitely would not share a dinner with him. This is the person who stole an estate and future from Harriton, who abused his wife and his own child, kidnapped Kathy and forced her to marry his son, bribed a lawyer not to do his job, took Kathy's inheritance, and confessed to bribing the sexton to dig up Catherine's grave and move side of her coffin. Lockwood is such an egotistical or smug person, I don't see him having any major influence of the story. I feel his existence is just an excuse to tell the story." I'm interested to see if Lockwood really does go away presently. At the end of the last chapter, he said, what did he say, he's going to London for 6 months or something? But I just feel like, well, I don't think we're going to follow him to London. It doesn't really seem to make sense. So I'm interested to see what happens there. All right, with that said, I think we should move on and read chapter 32, which goes a little bit like this. 1802. "This September I was invited to devastate the moors of a friend in the north, and on my journey to his abode, I unexpectedly came within 15 miles of Gimmerton. The ostler at the roadside public house was holding a pail of water to refresh my horses, when a cart of very green oats, newly reaped, passed by, and he remarked, 'Yon's for Gimmerton, nah, there alas 3 weeks after the other folk with their harvest.' 'Gimmerton,' I repeated. My residence in that locality had already grown dim and dreary. 'Ah, I know. How far is it from this?' 'Happened 14 mile o'er the hill and a rough road,' he answered. A sudden impulse seized me to visit Thrushcross Grange. It was scarcely noon, and I conceived that I might as well pass the night under my own roof as in an inn. Besides, I could spare a day easily to arrange matters with my landlord, and thus save myself the trouble of invading the neighbourhood again. Having rested a while, I directed my servant to inquire the way to the village, and with great fatigue to our beasts, we managed the distance in some 3 hours. I left him there, and proceeded down the valley alone. The grey church looked greyer, and the lonely churchyard lonelier. I distinguished a moor sheep cropping the short turf of the greaves. It was sweet, warm weather, too warm for travelling, but the heat did not hinder me from enjoying the delightful scenery above and below. Had I seen it nearer August, I am sure it would have tempted me to waste a month among its solitudes. In winter, nothing more dreary, in summer, nothing more divine than those glens shut in by hills and those bluff, bold swells of the heath. I reached the Grange before sunset, and knocked for admittance, but the family had retreated into the back premises. I judged by one thin blue wreath, curling from the kitchen chimney, and they did not hear. I rode into the court. Under the porch, a girl of 9 or 10 sat knitting, and an old woman reclined on the house steps, smoking a meditative pipe. "Is Mrs. Dean within?" I demanded of the dame. "Mistress Dean, nay," she answered. "She doesn't bide here, shoes up at the heights." "Are you the housekeeper then?" I continued. Heir or keep of the house, she replied. Well, I'm Mr. Lockwood, the master, and there are there any rooms to lodge me in, I wonder? I wish to stay all night. The maester, she cried in astonishment, what wherever knew ye were coming? Ye should have sent word. There's naught nor the dry nor menseful about the place. Naught there isn't. She threw down her pipe and bustled in. The girl followed, and I entered, too, soon perceiving that her report was true, and moreover that I had almost upset her wits by my unwelcome apparition. I bade her be composed. I would go out for a walk, and meantime she must try to prepare a corner of a sitting-room for me to sup in, and a bedroom to sleep in. No sweeping and dusting, only good fire and dry sheets were necessary. She seemed willing to do her best, though she thrust the hearth brush into the grates in mistake for the poker, and malappropriated several other articles of her craft, but I retired, confiding in her energy for a resting place against my return. Wuthering Heights was the goal of my proposed excursion, and afterthought brought me back when I had quitted the court. All about the heights, I inquired of the woman. Ere fro to your canal, she answered, scurrying away with a pan of hot cinders. I would have asked why Mrs. Dean had deserted the Grange, but it was impossible to delay her at such a crisis, so I turned away and made my exit, rambling leisurely along, with the glow of a sinking sun behind, and the mild glory of a rising moon in front, one fading and the other brightening, as I quitted the park and climbed the stony by-road branching off to Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling. Before I arrived in sight of it, all that remained of day was a beamless amber light along the west, but I could see every pebble on the path, and every blade of grass, by that splendid moon. I had neither to climb the gate nor to knock. It yielded to my hand. That is an improvement, I thought. And I noticed another, by the aid of my nostrils, a fragrance of stocks and wallflowers, wafted on the air from amongst the homely fruit trees. Both doors and lattices were open, and yet, as is usually the case in a cold district, a fine red fire illumined the chimney. The comfort which the eye derived from it rendered the extra heat endurable. But the house of Wuthering Heights is so large that the inmates have plenty of space for withdrawing out of its influence, and accordingly what inmates there were had stationed themselves not far from one of the windows. I could both see them and hear them talk before I entered, and looked and listened in consequence, being moved thereto by a mingled sense of curiosity and envy that grew as I lingered. "Contrary," said a voice as sweet as a silver bell. "That for the third time, you dunce, I'm not going to tell you again. Recollect, or I'll pull your hair." "Contrary, then," answered another in deep but softened tones, "and now kiss me for minding so well. No, read it over first correctly without a single mistake." The male speaker began to read. He was a young man, respectably dressed, and seated at a table, having a book before him. His handsome features glowed with pleasure, and his eyes kept impatiently wandering from the page to a small white hand over his shoulder, which recalled him by a smart slap on the cheek, whenever its owner detected such signs of inattention. Its owner stood behind, her light shining ringlets blending at intervals with his brown looks, as she bent to superintend his studies, and her face, it was lucky he could not see her face, or he would never have been so steady. I could, and I bit my lip in spite, at having thrown away the chance I might have had of doing something besides staring at its smiting beauty. Not free from further blunders, but the pupil claimed a reward and received at least 5 kisses, which, however, he generously returned. Then he came to the door, and from their conversation, I judged they were about to issue out and have a walk on the moors. I suppose I should be condemned in Harrington Earnshaw's heart, if not by his mouth, to the lowest pit in the infernal regions, if I showed my unfortunate person in his neighbourhood then, and feeling very mean and malignant, I skulked round to seek refuge in the kitchen. There was unobstructed admittance on that side also, and at the door sat my old friend Nellie Dean, sewing and singing a song, which is often interrupted from within by harsh words and scorn and intolerance uttered in far from musical accents. I'd rather by the half have am swearing my lugs from morn to night, nor hearken ye hesiver, said the tenant of the kitchen, in answer to an unheard speech of Nellie's. It's a blazing shame I cannot open the blessed book, but ye set up them glories to Satan, and all the flace and wickedness that ever were born in the world. Oh, you're a right naught, and choose another, and that poor lad'll be lost atween ye. Poor lad, he added with a groan, he's witched, I am sartin oont. O Lord, judge him, for there's naughten law nor justice among were rulers. No, or we should be sitting in flaming faggots, I suppose, retorted the singer, but wished old man, and read your Bible like a Christian, and never mind me. This is Fairy Annie's Wedding, a bonny tune, it goes to a dance. Mrs. Dean was about to recommence when I advanced and recognized me directly. She jumped to her feet, crying, "Why, bless you, Mr. Lockwood, how could you think of returning in this way? All's shut up at Thrushcross Grange. You should have given us notice." "I've arranged to be accommodated there for as long as I shall stay," I answered. "I depart again tomorrow. And how are you transplanted here, Mrs. Dean? Tell me that." "Zillah left, and Mr. Heathcliff wished me to come soon after you went to London, and stay till you returned, but step in, pray. Have you walked from Gimmerton this evening?" "From the Grange," I replied, "and while they make me lodging room there, I want to finish my business with your master, because I don't think of having another opportunity in a hurry." "What business, sir?" said Nellie, conducting me into the house. "He's gone out at present, and won't return soon." "About the rent," I answered. "Oh, then it is with Mrs. Heathcliff you must settle," she observed, "or rather with me. She has not learnt to manage her affairs yet, and I act for her. There's nobody else." I looked surprised. "Ah, you have not heard of Heathcliff's death?" "I see," she continued. "Heathcliff dead?" I exclaimed, astonished. "How long ago?"
3 months since. But sit down and let me take your hat. I'll tell you all about it. Stop, you have had nothing to eat, have you?"
"I want nothing. I have ordered supper at home. You sit down too. I never dreamt of his dying. Let me hear how it came to pass. You say you don't expect them back for some time, the young people."
"No, I have to scold them every evening for their late rambles, but they don't care for me. At least have a drink of our old ale. It will do you good. You seem weary."
She hastened to fetch it before I could refuse, and I heard Joseph asking whether it warrant a crying scoundrel that she should have followers at her time of life, and then to get them jocks out at the maester's cellar. He fair shamed to bide still and see it. She did not stay to retaliate, but re-entered in a minute, bearing a reaming silver pint, whose contents I lauded with becoming earnestness, and afterwards she furnished me with the sequel of Heathcliff's history. He had a queer end, as she expressed it. "I was summoned to Wuthering Heights within a fortnight of your leaving us," she said, "and I obeyed joyfully, for Catherine's sake. My first interview with her grieved and shocked me. She had altered so much since our separation. Mr. Heathcliff did not explain his reasons for taking a new mind about my coming here. He only told me he wanted me, and he was tired of seeing Catherine. I must make the little parlour my sitting room and keep her with me. It was enough if he were obliged to see her once or twice a day. She seemed pleased at this arrangement, and by degrees I smuggled over a great number of books and other articles that had formed her amusement at the Grange, and flattered myself we should get on in tolerable comfort. The delusion did not last long. Catherine, contented at first in a brief space, grew irritable and restless. For one thing, she was forbidden to move out of the garden, and it fretted her sadly to be confined to its narrow bounds as spring drew on. For another, in following the house, I was forced to quit her frequently, and she complained of loneliness. She preferred quarrelling with Joseph in the kitchen to sitting at peace in her solitude.
I did not mind their skirmishes, but Harriton was often obliged to seek the kitchen also when the master wanted to have the house to himself. And though in the beginning she either left it at his approach or quietly joined in my occupations and shunned remarking or addressing him, and though he was always as sullen and silent as possible, after a while she changed her behaviour and became incapable of letting him alone, talking at him, commenting on his stupidity and idleness, expressing her wonder how he could endure the life he lived, how he could sit a whole evening staring into the fire and dozing. "He's just like a dog, is he not, Alan?" she once observed, "or a cart horse. He does his work, he eats his food, and sleeps eternally. What a blank, dreary mind he must have. Do you ever dream, Harriton? And if you do, what is it about? But you can't speak to me." Then she looked at him, but he would neither open his mouth nor look again. "He's perhaps dreaming now," she continued. "He twitched his shoulder as Juno twitches hers. Ask him, Alan." "Mr. Harriton will ask the master to send you upstairs if you don't behave," I said. He had not only twitched his shoulder but clenched his fist, as if tempted to use it. "I know why Harriton never speaks when I am in the kitchen," she exclaimed on another occasion. "He is afraid I shall laugh at him. Alan, what do you think? He began to teach himself to read once, and because I laughed, he burned his books and dropped it. Was he not a fool?" "Were not you naughty?" I answered. "Answer me that." "Perhaps I was," she went on, "but I did not expect him to be so silly. Harriton, if I gave you a book, would you take it now? I'll try." She placed one she had been perusing on his hand. He flung it off and muttered, "If she did not give over, he would break her neck." "Well, I shall put it here," she said, "in the table drawer, and I'm going to bed." Then she whispered me to watch whether he touched it and departed, but he would not come near it, and so I informed her in the morning to her great disappointment. I saw she was sorry for his persevering sulkiness and indolence. Her conscience reproved her for frightening him off improving himself. She had done it effectually, but her ingenuity was at work to remedy the injury, while I ironed or pursued other such stationary employments as I could not well do in the parlour. She would bring some pleasant volume and read it aloud to me. When Harriton was there, she generally paused in an interesting part and left the book lying about, that she did repeatedly, but he was as obstinate as a mule, and instead of snatching at her bait it in wet weather, he took to smoking with Joseph, and they sat like automatons, one on each side of the fire, the elder happily too deaf to understand her wicked nonsense, as he would have called it, the younger doing his best to seem to disregard it. On fine evenings the latter followed his shooting expeditions, and Catherine yawned and sighed, and teased me to talk to her, and ran off into the court or garden the moment I began, and as a last resource cried and said she was tired of living, her life was useless. Mr. Heathcliff, who grew more and more disinclined to society, had almost banished Earnshaw from his apartment. Owing to an accident at the commencement of March, he became for some days a fixture in the kitchen. His gun burst while out on the hills by himself, a splinter cut his arm, and he lost a good deal of blood before he could reach home. The consequence was that, perforce, he was condemned to the fireside and tranquillity till he made it up again. It suited Catherine to have him there, at any rate. It made her hate her room upstairs more than ever, and she would compel me to find out business below that she might accompany me. On Easter Monday, Joseph went to Gimmerton Fair with some cattle, and in the afternoon I was busy getting up linen in the kitchen. Earnshaw sat morose, as usual, at the chimney corner, and my little mistress was beguiling an idle hour with drawing pictures on the window panes, varying her amusement by smothered bursts of songs and whispered ejaculations, and quick glances of annoyance and impatience in the direction of her cousin, who steadfastly smoked and looked into the grate. At a notice that I could do with her no longer intercepting my light, she removed to the hearthstone. I bestowed little attention on her proceedings, but presently I heard her begin, "I found out, Harriton, that I'm glad, that I should like you to be my cousin now, if you had not grown so cross at me and so rough." Hareton returned no answer. "Hareton, Hareton, Hareton, do you hear?" she continued. "Get off with you," he growled, with accompanying gruffness. "Let me take that pipe," she said, cautiously advancing her hand and abstracting it from his mouth. Before he could attempt to recover it, it was broken and behind the fire. He swore at her and seized another. "Stop," she cried. "You must listen to me first, and I can't speak while those clouds are floating in my face." "Will you go to the devil," he exclaimed ferociously, "and let me be?" "No," she persisted, "I won't. I can't tell what to do to make you talk to me, and you are determined not to understand. When I call you stupid, I don't mean anything. I don't mean that I despise you. Come, you shall take notice of me, Hareton. You are my cousin, and you shall own me. I shall have naught to do with you, and you and your murky pride, and your damned mocking tricks," he answered. "I'll go to hell, body and soul, before I look sideways after you again. Side out of the gate now, this minute." Catherine frowned and retreated to the window seat, chewing her lip and endeavouring, by humming an eccentric tune, to conceal a growing tendency to sob. "You should be friends with your cousin, Mr. Hareton," I interrupted, "since she repents of her sauciness. It would do you a great deal of good. It would make you another man to have her for a companion." "A companion," he cried, "when she hates me and does not think me fit to wipe her shoon. Nay, if it made me a king, I'd not be scorned for seeking her goodwill any more." "It is not I who hate you, it is you who hate me," wept Cathy, no longer disguising her trouble. "You hate me as much as Mr. Heathcliff does, and more." "You're a damn liar," began Earnshaw. "Why have I made him angry? By taking your part, then 100 times, and that when you sneered at and despised me, and go on plaguing me, and I'll step in yonder, and say you worried me out of the kitchen." "I didn't know you took my part," she answered, drying her eyes, "and I was miserable and bitter at everybody. But now I thank you and beg you to forgive me. What can I do besides?" She returned to the hearth and frankly extended her hand. He blackened and scowled like a thundercloud, and kept his fist resolutely clenched and his gaze fixed on the ground. Catherine, by instinct, must have divined it was obdurate perversity, and not dislike, that prompted this dogged conduct, for, after remaining an instant undecided, she stooped and impressed on his cheek a gentle kiss. The little rogue thought I had not seen her, and drawing back, she took her former station by the window, quite demurely. I shook my head reprovingly, and then she blushed and whispered, "Well, what should I have done, Alan? He wouldn't shake hands, and he wouldn't look. I must show him some way that I like him, that I want to be friends." Whether the kiss convinced Hareton, I cannot tell. He was very careful for some minutes that his face should not be seen, and when he did raise it, he was sadly puzzled where to turn his eyes. Catherine employed herself in wrapping a handsome book neatly in white paper and having it tied it with a bit of ribbon, and addressed it to Mr. Hareton Earnshaw. She desired me to be her ambassadress, and convey the present to its destined recipient. "And tell him, if he'll take it, I'll come and teach him to read it right," she said. "And if he refuses it, I'll go upstairs and never tease him again." I carried it and repeated the message, anxiously watched by my employer. Hareton would not open his fingers, so I laid it on his knee. He did not strike it off either. I returned to my work. Catherine leaned her head and arms on the table till she heard the slight rustle of the cover being removed. Then she stole away and quietly seated herself beside her cousin. He trembled and his face glowed. All his rudeness and all his surly harshness had deserted him. He could not summon courage at first to utter a syllable in reply to her questioning look and her murmured petition. "Say you forgive me, Hareton, do. You can make me so happy by speaking that little word." He muttered something inaudible. "And you'll be my friend," added Catherine interrogatively. "Nay, you'll be ashamed of me every day of your life," he answered. "And the more ashamed, the more you know me, and I cannot abide it." "So you won't be my friend," she said, smiling as sweet as honey and creeping close up. I overheard no further distinguishable talk, but On looking around again, I perceived two such radiant countenances bent over the page of the accepted book, that I did not doubt the treaty had been ratified on both sides, and the enemies were thenceforth sworn allies. The work they studied was full of costly pictures, and those of their position had charm enough to keep them unmoved till Joseph came home. He, the poor man, was perfectly aghast at the spectacle of Catherine seated on the same bench with Harriet and Earnshaw, leaning her hand on his shoulder and confounded at his favourite's endurance of her proximity. It affected him too deeply to allow an observation on the subject that night. His emotion was only revealed by the immense sighs he drew as he solemnly spread his large Bible on the table and overlaid it with dirty banknotes from his pocketbook, the produce of the day's transactions. At length he summoned Harriton from his seat. "Tack these to the maister's, lad," he said, "and bide there. I his gang up on my own arm. His hoss oil's neither mensful nor seemly for us. We must side out and search another." "Catherine, come," I said. "We must side out too. I've done my ironing. Are you ready to go?" "It's not 8 o'clock," she answered, rising unwillingly. "Harriton, I'll leave this book upon the chimney-piece, and I'll bring some more tomorrow." "Only books that ye leave I shall tack into the house," said Joseph. "It'll be mitch if ye find em again, so ye ma please yoursel." Cathy threatened that his library should pay for hers, and smiling as she passed Harriton, went singing upstairs, lighter of heart, I venture to say, than ever she had been under that roof before, except perhaps during her earliest visits to Linton. The intimacy thus commenced grew rapidly. Though it encountered temporary interruptions, Earnshaw was not to be civilized with a wish, and my young lady was no philosopher and no paragon of patience, but both their minds tending to the same point, one loving and desiring to esteem, and the other loving and desiring to be esteemed, they contrived in the end to reach it. "You see, Mr. Lockwood, it was easy enough to win Mrs. Heathcliff's heart, but now I'm glad you did not try. The crown of all my wishes will be the union of these two. I shall envy no one on their wedding day. There won't be a happier woman than myself in England." Alright, there we go. That was chapter 32. I apologize for the reading today. As soon as I started reading or speaking in the podcast at the very beginning, I just had this like sneeze fit. I was sneezing for like 5 minutes, which I obviously edited out of the podcast. But I'm all kind of sinusy and sneezy, so I don't know what's going on there. I wouldn't be surprised if I wake up tomorrow morning feeling like I've got a cold or something. And then I was kind of like out of breath and all kind of congested in the face during the whole podcast. So I apologize if my voice is all gooey and gross. Anyway, have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thanks for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.